We start today with a look at violence in our schools, but we're not talking about student gun violence. We're shifting our focus to stun guns and the school police who use them. You might know them as tasers, a common brand of the weapon. Last year, 15-year-old Jalijah Jones was a freshman in high school in Kalamazoo, Michigan, when he had an unexpected and violent run-in with an armed school police officer.
He got in a small fight with another student. It was over a small amount of money. There was pushing and shoving and some punches thrown, but no one actually got hurt. It was quickly broken up, and one of the students walked away. Jalijah had a harder time calming down. He was kind of huffing and puffing around the hallway, but school security came and they seemed to have it under control. They restrained him. At some point, though, a school police officer came by, and while school security guards were dealing with him, the school police officer took him and tasered him.
Tasered him at his school after a minor altercation.
Jalijah fell to the ground. He lost control of his body. The school police officer handcuffed him and ended up dragging him through the hallway. There's actually some video of it. His body is completely limp. He ended up getting arrested for disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, and he's still fighting those charges today. And he spent many hours in the hospital. He has some scars from the incident.
I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And it turns out what happened to Jalijah has happened to students at U.S. public schools across the country. So what gives? Rebecca Klein is the education reporter for HuffPost you just heard from, and she's been looking into how often students are getting stunned by their own school safety officers.
So the problem is we really don't know. There is no local, state, or federal agency keeping track of this number. So we set out a few years ago to create our own count. Because this isn't being systemically tracked in any way, the only way for us to get this information was to look through old local news reports over the years. So we've been tracking local news reports since 2011 to try and get a very bare minimum count to see at least how often this is reported. And we found that since September 2011, students have been tasered or shot with a stun gun by school police officers at least 120 times.
And that's like 120 instances across the country?
Yeah, across the country.
Now, I'm just curious, why don't schools keep track of these incidences? You would think that this is something serious enough to warrant some sort of record. Is that not right?
Yeah, so the complication is the police officers who are based in schools are actually employed by local police departments. So they don't necessarily answer to a school administrator or a school principal. They answer to local police departments, and local police departments don't keep this data. I don't know what their overall use of force data looks like, but they certainly do not keep it specific to children in schools.
What does a taser actually do to a body in general? And then how does it impact a child's body?
In the worst case scenario, tasers can cause cardiac arrest. And actually, on the warning label of the taser weapon, it warns against using the weapon on low body mass index in children. And obviously, if you're working in a school, many of the students there are going to be small children. And it's more likely that children will suffer from cardiac arrest from these weapons. And then beyond that, there has been a case in the past where when you are tasered, your body becomes debilitated and you might fall to the ground. You're incapacitated. And so there was a child a few years ago who was tasered and in the midst of falling to the very harsh ground of the hallway, ended up having to get into a coma because he was so severely brain damaged from how hard he hit his head.
Now, obviously, we don't want to minimize anyone's pain, but I'm thinking 120 cases across the United States is a pretty small number. Wouldn't you agree?
It's a small number, but it is the very bare minimum. As we know, there are not a tremendous amount of local news outlets anymore, and this might not be the priority topic for their coverage. And oftentimes, there's no reason why a local news outlet would gain whiff of it. So we're under the impression that this is probably happening a lot more than we know about. 30% of school police officers, according to government data, carry these weapons. So again, this is very much a minimum count.
You said 30%. So not all school resource officers are carrying these. Why are they carrying them? Who makes that decision? Is it the local police department? Is it usually in response to something that's happened at a school? For example, do police departments say, you know, this school has been under threat or has experienced something like a mass shooting, let's give our police officers tasers?
Most of the time, school police officers, if they carry a taser when they're on the streets dealing with adults, then they would wear the exact same weapons into the school. They don't normally remove tools from their arsenal when they enter a school. So in most cases, it is under the purview of the local police department. Sometimes school boards will intervene and have a specific say over what weapons are carried. But from what I understand, it really depends on a case-by-case basis, depending on the locality.
Well, and one of the things that we know, I mean, I've reported on this, and I'm sure lots of folks have been looking at this, is that schools increasingly across the United States are using and relying more on police departments and police officers as these school resource officers to sort of manage their security and other issues. But this seems to be a bit beyond that. This looks like it's really talking about school discipline and who's being disciplined and who isn't. Are you noticing any racial or gender patterns or distinctions in the research that you have? Are there certain populations that are disproportionately affected by tasing versus others?
So it's hard to draw those conclusions from the data we have because it is so incomplete at this point. But research does show that Black children are disproportionately suspended, expelled, and also they are disproportionately getting criminal referrals from these police officers who are based in schools, even for low-level offenses. So we think it's probably fair to assume that they are also bearing the brunt of use of these weapons.
We're talking about tasers used by police against kids in school. Rebecca Klein of HuffPost has been tracking instances of school officers using tasers against students. I can only imagine if a parent finds out that their child has been tasered, what the response would be. But what are the parents saying that you've spoken to?
Many of the parents that I've spoken to are supportive of the idea of having police officers in schools, especially amid the spate of deadly school shootings that we've seen, but had no idea that these weapons could be used on students for normal teenage or adolescent misbehavior. So while they might feel more comfortable with the idea of high secure environments in their child's schools, they're very deeply uncomfortable with the idea that these police officers could turn against their own students who aren't armed intruders, who are just going about their daily lives. And in many cases, I found that they are shocked that this is possible.
Rebecca, whatever happened to detention? I mean, I feel like we've gone, and I mean that in all seriousness, I feel like we've gone from minor infractions that are relatively normal, and I'm not talking about school shootings, I'm talking about, you know, graffiti here and there, or getting into a scuffle with a classmate, or not, you know, being attentive in class, and just not being tased, but being put in detention. I mean, have we passed that level in the United States? Are we past that anymore?
I think that's a very good question. What you have to remember is that when you have police officers in schools, these police officers are most likely going to treat children the same way that they treat any civilian engaging in some sort of misbehavior. So, for example, if an adult was on the street vandalizing a piece of property, that would result in a serious punishment. But in schools, we know it may not be uncommon for a young child to be vandalizing a desk in some way or engaging in something they probably shouldn't be doing, but isn't that big of a deal in the scheme of things. And that now might result in them also getting referred to law enforcement, which could be very problematic for their future.
I'm also wondering about any training for law enforcement here. I mean, you mentioned an autistic child who had been tasered and, you know, for having an outburst in class and knowing the little I know about children on the spectrum. I mean, those are sort of normal behaviors. And if police are not trained to deal with children in this very specific population, I can't imagine this going very well in the future. Is there any talk of policy implementation or training on how and when to implement this type of technology?
So typically, this is completely decided on a locality-by-locality basis. There are trainings that exist, but these trainings cost money and they're expensive. So if a district or department doesn't have extra funds, then they're not going to get it. And that's just something that's going to fall by the wayside.
I'm sorry. I'm just kind of stunned about that answer. What about schools? We talked about parents. We talked about police. What are schools saying about this? The schools that you're talking to, are they saying this is a critical part of their security protocols going forward?
Yeah. So how a school interacts with the police officers that they house really depends. Some school districts take in these officers and they don't really have any specific rules for how these officers are supposed to be interacting with students. Some schools are much more vigilant about it and they have a strict contract with the police officers and the police department saying what exactly these police officers are there to do and how they should be engaging with students. But again, it really depends. And most of the time, school districts are just allowing the police officers to come in and treat the children as they would treat people in their local police officer jobs.
Rebecca Klein is an education reporter for HuffPost. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
My name is Sina from Richardson, Texas. Police security, having tasers, I personally don't think that it's a good idea. I have chosen to homeschool my children mostly their entire lives. And being older teenagers now, I have been watching all of the security increases in the schools, and I've been even more grateful for our choices to not have my children exposed to or involved or dealing with any of those issues.
Hi, this is Marcy from San Antonio. My child's school has armed officers when they're out at the play area. These are armed, off-duty police officers. I'm certain they'll do anything necessary to keep the kids safe, and I totally support it.
This is John calling from Palm City, Florida. The deployment of tasers from officers has to be recorded. So in the event that a taser is deployed onto a person, the duration, the length is recorded, and there's record tracking purposes on the back end to make sure that no misuse is done.
Hi, this is Jared calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Just listened to the report on the tasers in schools from the very beginning, all of the phrasing, all of the way the opinions were put forth with a conclusion already drawn that this was an unacceptable use of force, period. I would have loved to have heard a police officer's counterpoint of why they decided to use tasers.
We appreciate that feedback, Jared. And just to let you know, we did try reaching out to school districts and safety officers for an interview, but so far everyone has declined to comment or just hasn't gotten back to us. So if you're a school resource officer or a police officer stationed at a school, we want to hear from you about your experience. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.
And Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
We turn now to Texas and a recent instance of police violence, not against a student, but against a civilian in his own home. 26-year-old Botham Shinjan was shot and killed inside his Dallas apartment by off-duty police officer Amber Geiger. Geiger told authorities she thought she had walked into her own apartment and that she mistook Jean for an intruder. Geiger was arrested on manslaughter charges on Sunday, but the incident is prompting a hard look at violence perpetrated by police officers who are off the clock. Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and he's also a former cop. And he's one of the few people collecting data on this underreported trend of off-duty police crime.
When we look at the numbers, about 900 non-federal sworn law enforcement officers, so that would be state troopers, police officers, deputy sheriffs, about 900 a year are arrested. And I have data going back to about 2005 in my database. So about 900 a year. And when we look at those 900 officers who are arrested annually, about 60% of them are arrested for crimes that occur while an officer is off duty.
the case that we're looking at is obviously pretty unique, I would imagine. I think some of the things that are surprising here are that, at least what we're starting to see, is one of the reasons that's being given is that she was working, the officer had worked a very long shift, could have led to some sort of that situational lack of awareness. Do you find that officers who are just overtired are committing these crimes?
You know, it's difficult from the data that I'm able to collect and analyze, but I can tell you anecdotally, and I can tell you from other research that's been done, is that stress, shift work, post-traumatic stress syndrome, these are all factors that come into play with officers who are making the wrong decisions on use of force incidents, both on duty and off duty. So I don't think we can discount that as a possibility. But, you know, with these types of crimes, there are things that we otherwise can't discount. We can't take race out of the equation. Anytime you're dealing with things in the criminal justice system, you have to look at race-related issues. And then one of the concerns that I've had for many years now has to do with officers and off-duty firearms. So police officers in most jurisdictions across the country are encouraged, if not required, to carry their service weapons with them when they're in public while off-duty. And what I've seen is that hundreds of times over the last decade, we've seen officers involved in off-duty incidents that can't be described in any other way as bizarre violence. You just can't explain the facts. Using firearms in ways that rational people would not use a firearm.
The encouragement to carry a weapon when you're off duty, where does that come from?
There's actually a federal law that allows off-duty police officers to carry their firearms across state lines without any sort of registration of their firearms to carry off duty in other states. So it's a big issue, and I think we have to look at the police subculture and the way that police officers are socialized. And I know from my own background, I was a police officer for several years a long time ago, that police officers are socialized into an us versus them mentality. And quite literally, anyone who's not a law enforcement officer in this type of situation is perceived as a threat, as a potential enemy. I think the police socialization process and the police subculture is an integral component of helping us to understand what happened here.
Are there any data that show differences in gender? This was obviously a white woman police officer. We've seen other instances where women police officers have been involved in shootings, specifically of Black Americans. Does your data show any gender breakdown?
Well, only about 5% of the cases in my database. So we have about 15,000 cases in my database of officers who were arrested over the last 14 years, and that's about 12 or 13,000 officers. The reason for the difference in the numbers there is that some officers have more than one arrest case during our study years for a variety of reasons. So only about 5% of those cases are female officers. When we look at those cases and try to do statistical analyses, we actually see that the police women, the female officers, are just as violent as the male officers in terms of the types of crimes they're getting involved in. And that extends to officer-involved domestic violence and other off-duty crimes as well.
And I'm also wondering if you're noticing any patterns in terms of the victims of these crimes. You mentioned race earlier in this conversation and the impact that that has on policing. It's no surprise we've continued to see instances where white officers kill and shoot indiscriminately and indiscriminately kill Black Americans who are unarmed. Is this a pattern that you see in the data as well?
You know, for many years, we did not collect data on the race of the officers or the race of the victims in these cases. I just didn't think that it was something we'd be able to figure out very easily from the data we had. And about 7 or 8 years ago, one of my graduate research assistants came to me and said, you know, I think we really need to track the race of the officers here, race and ethnicity. So we started to do that with a great deal of success. And what we're finding is we can figure out the race and ethnicity of the victims in about 20 to 25% of the arrest cases. But we have so many cases in our database, within the next 6 months to a year, we're going to start to have enough that we'll be able to do statistical analyses and directly answer your questions about the impact of race and ethnicity in these police crime cases involving violence.
And you also said you've been an officer yourself. When you talk to police officers, Are there concerns about these types of incidences, off-duty carrying their weapon? Do they want to do this when they're off-duty? I knew one police officer who actually felt that he should not carry his weapon off while he was off-duty and would keep it at home. What's the sense, just on a personal level, from the officers that you know?
Well, it varies, but I would say that, you know, 8 out of 10 officers seem to have a very close relationship with their gun and badge, and they view it as something that they wouldn't leave home without. And I realize when I come out and say things like, well, I think it's time that we reconsider whether off-duty officers should always be carrying guns, it's something that law enforcement officers, many of them, are not happy with when I say that. But when I say that, I'm also thinking of the fact that when we look at the fact that about 60% of the crimes for which officers are arrested that are off-duty are violent-related crimes. And of those violent-related off-duty crimes, about 42% of them are alcohol-related. In other words, the officer was intoxicated at the time of the crime. It's very troubling. You know, we just need to look a lot more into it. And I think we need to keep talking about it. We need to go back to these policy issues and readdress it and continue the discussion going.
Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Phil, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Last week, I found myself looking around this city, my city, New York City, struck by the number of empty storefronts and thinking about how many unique places we've lost. So I put out a call on Twitter asking, is there a beloved neighborhood joint, something essential to your community that's been shut down? And boy, did it strike a nerve. I got hundreds of passionate responses. Pop Shop, CBGB, Five Points, Ray's Pizza, Towel Records, Manny's Music, Coliseum Bookstore, the list goes on and on and on. And like many of you, I remember dancing, yes, dancing, at Nell's, eating brunch at Yaffa Cafe, and browsing through CDs, yes, CDs, at the Virgin Megastore. And I miss these places because they were unique to the culture and fabric of New York City. But it's not just a New York thing. Yesterday on the show, I put out a call to all of you to tell us what you miss in your neighborhood.
Hi, my name is Bryant, and I live in Park City, Utah. There used to be a restaurant on Main Street called Zoom, which had great food and was located in a really cool historic train depot building. And it was owned by the Sundance Kid himself. But unfortunately, a couple years ago, they were forced out of business unfairly by the landlord. Zoom, you are missed.
Hi, my name is Shayna. I'm calling from Flanders, New Jersey, and I grew up in a small town named Byram. And I cringe and get upset every time I drive into my hometown because there was a restaurant called the Lockwood Tavern that had been there since the 1700s. That was a town staple. And it was sold out, torn down, and it's now a CVS. So everybody in town's been pretty upset about that. And the Historical Society even tried to prevent it from being torn down, but they had no luck. So it's a pretty sad one for us.
Hi, my name is Rick DeBase from Needham, Massachusetts. Many friendly ice cream shops are closed now in Massachusetts. It was always a good place to take the family, and when traveling on the road, for a quick bite, a little bit above fast food joints.
Hi, it's Shannon from St. Paul, Minnesota. There was a nice bar restaurant in my neighborhood, and it seemed to be on the leading edge of an uptick in small businesses in my neighborhood. And they recently closed, stating that they had never made a profit in the 4 years they operated. It makes me really nervous for what's to come for all the small businesses in my area.
Hello, this is Deirdre from Glenwood Landing. For 25 years, a lovely couple from Greece owned and ran the Brookville Diner. The food was amazing, and we loved going there weekly. When their 25-year lease was up, the owner refused to renew it. They were forced out of business, and a TD Bank was built after they destroyed the diner. Of course, it'll be a cold day in hell before I patronize that bank.
Nostalgia is, of course, a piece of this. And we long for the old-timey places that take us back to when we were younger, places that make our neighborhoods feel like home. But something else is going on here.
Your favorite diner closes not because people aren't eating diner food anymore. It closes because the landlord quadruples the rent.
Jeremiah Moss, the author of Vanishing New York, How a Great City Lost Its Soul, has been writing about these closings for more than a decade. And he says what's playing out in New York City is happening in urban centers all across the country. And he calls it hyper-gentrification.
Now we have a city that doesn't feel like New York in the same way. It is a city filled with chain stores where small businesses are, they're not being put out because of competition or the free market. They're being put out by exorbitant rents. It's really not just gentrification that I'm talking about. It is corporatization. It is homogenization. It's the takeover of a very bland monoculture.
You see, when one of these places closes, it leaves a hole. But it's not just an empty storefront. They leave a cultural hole, a social hole, and many times an economic hole. We mourn places like this because we share them, and they become beloved, unique parts of the fabric of our communities. There's still many existing physical spaces that serve as anchors for our community. Take the Seward Park Library on Manhattan's Lower East Side.
What time is it? Time for you to get a watch.
On a recent morning, a group of fidgety preteens is waiting for the library to open. And when it finally does, kids flood the first floor. Older patrons find seats at computers and tables. And 17-year-old Z Wen heads straight for a teen zone.
I came here almost every day to meet up with my friends. I mean, we can't really talk too loud here, but you know, since the computers are next to each other now, we could easily communicate with each other if we're playing the same game and all.
On the second floor, elementary schoolers crowd around low-slung tables. Three siblings are locked in a heated game of Connect Four.
Why?
You didn't notice this?
A group of toddlers and their caretakers cram into a side room for story time.
Can we practice and shake our sillies out? Thank you. Yeah, can we go a little shake, 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 shake? Oh, that's a good shake. Thank you so much. That's a great shake. Thank you.
The library is also a place for new moms, like Catherine City, who's bouncing her toddler on her hip.
It gets really boring and lonely being at home and just getting out where I know that she's welcome to run around and scream. And so, yeah, it's just a warm place that I'm really appreciative of.
One of the senior librarians here, Andrew Fairweather, says it's his job to elevate library patrons however he can. As a mentor, a counselor, an editor, or even a friend.
People come to us for help. I think it's important not just to do the bare minimum for society as well, but also strive to give people good things in life as well.
The Seward Park Library is one of the places that sociologist and author Eric Kleinenberg examines in his new book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And he joins me now in studio. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So this segment, these last two segments have just got my heart filled with joy. The Seward Park Library was my library. But let's go back to this idea of social infrastructure. What is it? How do you define it?
Well, it's probably a new concept, so I think it's worth spending a moment on it. I define it as the physical places and organizations, places like churches or YMCAs, that shape our interactions. And when social infrastructure is robust, it promotes relationship building, informal ties that become something greater. And when the social infrastructure is neglected or degraded, it makes us far more likely to hunker down and be alone.
Now, you spent a significant amount of time in the Seward Park Library. We heard some of the wonderful sounds that came out of that. Why did you choose that place to focus on as one of these examples?
Well, it's in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which is gentrifying, transforming very quickly. It remains a neighborhood dominated by immigrants with high levels of poverty. But there's also lots of newcomers and a complicated mix. The library itself is a Carnegie institution. Andrew Carnegie, you know, one of the wealthiest people in the world at the time of his life, was also one of the great philanthropists and helped to build more than 2,800 libraries around the world. And there's this amazing building there that has served as an anchor for 100 years or more. And I wanted to go there because I was interested in a place that could bring people of all from all walks of life together. And it was extraordinary to be there during a time when, on most days, to be honest, I felt pretty down about the world.
Well, I think a lot of us are feeling that way. And one of the things that came out in this Twitter thread that I surprisingly, you know, has gotten so much attention is that sort of, some people said, wow, thanks for bringing up all these memories. And other people felt really sad. And I guess my question to you is, are we just indulging in nostalgia when we talk about these places? Or is this part of an expected evolution in cities? Or you see this as maybe something more important than that?
I do, and I don't see it as nostalgia. The library is a living institution, and it's so important to emphasize that today. You know, over the summer, there was an article that came out in Forbes arguing that libraries are obsolete, that they're not worth the public investment, and that we should knock them down and replace them with Amazon stores. I order books on Amazon occasionally. I'm not against Amazon altogether, but if we got rid of the libraries, we'd be getting rid of a vital part of our social infrastructure. They are overrun with people. I mean, my heart warmed also listening to those voices. It is extraordinary the number of people and the diversity of people who come into the library every day, not just for getting out books, but for learning English as a second language, for finding companionship. There are older people who go there for book groups. There's a Library Lanes program in the Brooklyn Public Library where older people go, put on bowling jerseys, and get an Xbox to compete against other libraries. The place is actually booming, and I think the problem is we've neglected to fund and support them, and so they're increasingly overrun. It's not nostalgic to say we need more institutions like that at a time like now, because it's, in my view, the best possible way to restore some sense of a common purpose. It's the best of what we do in this country.
I have so many thoughts thinking initially about class, right? Because I feel like when we think about these spaces, we forget that there are people who don't have phones, who don't have access to Amazon, who can't afford, or really maybe just don't want to download books, right? And so this access, the issue of accessibility for all classes of New Yorkers and or Americans seems to be becoming less and less important.
You know, the library is one of the only places that wants to give you something. Why do we need a library when we can go to Starbucks or McDonald's or the hipster cafe? You know, there's a cost of entry there. And we know from the Starbucks case in Philadelphia that if you don't even pay in a prime way, you'll be seen as suspicious, especially if you're a person of color in this country.
Well, and let's even talk about, I mean, this got me the other day. I went to a place to go get a cup of coffee, a private, you know, place. And they said, no, we're cashless. And I said, well, I just want a cup of coffee and I cannot make my purchase there. I'm wondering, do you see this extending to private places as well, private businesses like diners? That was a big one that came up in this thread. Restaurants, people who are saying, yeah, I used to go there and it was mom and pop running the place. I mean, are private businesses also part of this fabric, this social infrastructure?
They very much can be, but they have to be accessible. And if you run your place with a strict limit where 30 minutes and you're out, no loitering, which is what the signs say all around the Seward Park Library in the private retail facilities, people feel like they have to leave. So not everyone is at home in a shop that offers a $6 coffee. And it's important to remember that.
What about private places, the diners that people are missing, the dance clubs? And I say dance clubs because people don't even dance anymore. What about those places and how important are they to this social infrastructure that you're talking about?
They can be incredibly important. Take in African-American neighborhoods, the beauty salon, which is or the barbershop. There are movies about what a central place this is for generations to connect with one another. The problem is that some commercial entities are very exclusive, and they either signal indirectly to people that they're not welcome there. The very old people and poor people aren't welcome in a place that requires a certain kind of, you know, credit card and doesn't have cash, as you said, or that I has a $6 coffee.
I could not believe that, frankly. I was like, I just want a cup of coffee, and I could not make the purchase.
So they can work very well, but they can be exclusive. And I think we've reached a moment where I don't think the market is going to supply us with all the things we need to reestablish our social bonds. And so this book is about the kinds of collective investments that we can make in places that will make all of our lives better. That idea of palaces for the people that came from Carnegie, I think, is important for us to remember today, because too often the people who run our cities and our government run programs that work for an exclusive set of people, make their lives very, very good, and don't do enough for the rest of us. And I think much of the resentment in the country that's driving politics these days comes in part from the fact that it doesn't seem that the public sector is making our lives better too.
Well, and I keep thinking about one of the places, whether we like it or not, here in New York City, that has sort of been a communal gathering place, is the subway, right? Which is, quite frankly, a disaster in this city. And I'm wondering, to your point about the government not really taking a stand and putting these things up to, you know, the importance that they need to be, whether it's libraries, public transportation. I mean, all of these things, I know people who have met, you know, their significant other on public transportation.
At schools as well. When the government neglects our vital social infrastructure and lets it get degraded, we suffer in those experiences. And rather than enjoying and embracing the institutions and becoming champions of it and taking pride in it, as we once did with those things, those things once make New York City a great place, Chicago a great place, San Francisco a great place. We now feel that they've been depleted, and we get angry when we go into them, or we feel upset about them. We feel let down, and we want to go in some radically different direction. I think for years we've gone in a market-focused direction, and some good things have come out of the market, but also incredible inequalities and a sense that many people have been left out of this. And so I think it's not important to be nostalgic, but it is important to look back and to look forward at the institutions that still have some capacity to bring us together. And the hope that came in the process of writing this book was that I actually found across the United States and around the world many places that are working well, that are working as vital social infrastructure.
So give us some examples, because I don't want people to walk away, as some of them did after the Twitter thread, feeling, oh, well, this is really sad and depressing and nostalgic, because I feel that way too. Like, where is it going well? Who's doing it well?
Well, I was on a panel last night where we discussed the case of the Netherlands, which has embraced the challenge of climate security, which is probably worth bringing up as the U.S. braces for another major storm, so that when they're building water protection, what they have to do to stay alive in the Netherlands, they're also building facilities that double as social infrastructure. So a water storage system, a basin that functions like a public plaza and park 360 days a year, but that can be converted with walls that go up into a water management facility on days that are very rainy. And in fact, we're now building systems like that in New York because of the Rebuild by Design competition following Sandy, thinking about 21st century infrastructure that can both protect us and also improve our lives every day.
I want to ask you a couple questions as we're winding down this segment here about the health and well-being elements of social infrastructure. We sort of talked about the emotional aspects of it and the public aspects of it. But there, you know, you talk about how this social infrastructure can relate to everything from the opioid epidemic on to, you give the example of a heat wave in Chicago. Like, tell us about how this influences our health outcomes.
Yeah, well, my first insights into the social infrastructure came when I was working on my first book called Heatwave. And one kind of remarkable finding is I looked at neighborhoods that were almost identical demographically, the same kinds of people lived there, same poverty level, same racial composition, but had dramatically different outcomes during the disaster. And some neighborhoods had very high death rates, and some neighborhoods that were very poor and very segregated turned out to be safer than even the most affluent places in Chicago. It was my home city where I grew up. And it turned out, when you looked very closely, what was driving the difference was the social infrastructure. The neighborhoods that had robust sidewalk lives, that had local libraries that had dense commercial establishments that were drawing people out of their homes and into the streets promoted healthy social contact. And the neighborhoods that had abandoned properties, empty lots, not a lot of retail, weak churches, they had very high death rates. And then I discovered it wasn't just that there was a difference in the heat wave, that one pair of neighborhoods that had disparate death rates had a 5-year longer life expectancy in the place with good social infrastructure than in the place without it. So it affects our daily life too. And now a number of additional studies have backed that up.
And with regards to the opioid crisis, is it the opposite? Are these folks that have been impacted because of a lack of social infrastructure?
Very much. The opioid crisis has hit hardest in communities that have been devastated by deindustrialization and by the hollowing out of the towns where they are. It's an epidemic that's driven by an effort to kill pain, and a lot of that pain is social pain. You know, interestingly, some social scientists have discovered that communities that have higher levels of social capital are less at risk of opioid addiction and overdose problems than communities that do not have that. And we also know that one of the most innovative experiments happening in the world of drug policy these days involves cities, more outside of the U.S., but perhaps it will come to the U.S., cities that create zones, protected zones, where people who are addicted can use safely around other people who could protect them. Because what's really dangerous is, you know, not just overdosing, but overdosing alone where no one can help.
Eric Kleinenberg is a sociology professor and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. Eric, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
And we want to return to our top story today, the use of stun guns, commonly called tasers, in schools. We've already got a bunch of calls from you on the issue.
Hey, this is Alexandra from West Palm Beach, Florida. And honestly, tasers in schools, I don't agree with them. But if they have to for adolescents, because nowadays their behavior is not what it used to be when I was in school and, you know, we didn't take fighting or anything as normal behavior. It was dealt with appropriately, but nowadays these kids apparently seem to be a little bit more aggressive.
Hi, Ursula Sotomayor calling from Pembroke Pines, Florida. I think we're leaving way too much responsibility to schools about our children's discipline. We, the parents, need to be more strict at home and teach them good morals and harsher discipline so that they don't have to go through taser guns or any other type of extreme disciplinary actions in school.
Tell us your thoughts, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.